Thank you for visiting RayMayhewOnline.com. You're listening to an audio resource by Ray Mayhew.
I'm beginning a session on 2nd and 3rd John, but before listening to this, it's important to listen to the introduction to all three books that I did on my first session on the Epistle of 1 John, because knowing the background to these books is crucial if we're to understand them in any depth. Both 2nd and 3rd John would each fit on a single sheet of papyrus. A standard sheet of papyrus measured about 10 by 8 inches, and this length is typical of informal letters in the ancient world. If they went longer, as of course most of the other New Testament letters do, then they would stitch them together, but this was a lot more work. Both 2nd and 3rd John are said to come from somebody called the Elder. 2nd John begins, "The Elder to the elect lady and her children." And 3rd John begins, "The Elder to the beloved Gaius." As I mentioned in the introduction, that I told you you could find at the beginning of 1 John, John describes himself as the elder, despite the fact that there were other elders in the church at Ephesus. However, John was unique among them because he was not only an elder, but also an apostle, and now almost a patriarchal figure among the churches, particularly in Asia Minor and Ephesus, where he lived when he was an older man. So the title, "The Elder," is a great description of the apostle who had outlived all the other apostles, as far as we know. However, some doubt that these letters were written by John the Apostle, and they cite a reference by Papias, who lived from about 70 to 146 AD, and his writing to an elder called John the Aged, who was a notable figure in Ephesus, and he distinguishes him from John the Apostle. However, the reliability of this document is questionable, and it seems most straightforward to adopt the traditional view that 2nd and 3rd John were written by John the Apostle. They fit his style and reflect his theology, and so there doesn't seem to be any convincing reason to believe that John the Elder was not John the Apostle. Barclay points out that these short letters have much in common. Just a few examples. 2nd John begins, "The elder to the elect lady and her children, whom I love in truth." 3rd John begins, "The elder to the beloved Gaius, whom I love in the truth." Again, 2nd John, this is 2nd John verse 4, "I rejoice greatly to find some of your children following the truth." And 3rd John echoes, "No greater joy can I have than this, to hear that my children follow the truth." And again, 2nd John comes to an end with the statements, "Though I have much to write to you, I would rather not use paper and ink, but I hope to come to see you and talk with you face to face, so that our joy may be complete." That's 2nd John verse 12. Then 3rd John comes to an end with the words, "I had much to write to you, but I would rather not write with pen and ink. I hope to see you soon and we'll talk together face to face. 3 John verse 13 and 14. So there are some distinct parallels between the two letters that actually become important as we get into the exegesis of the verses themselves. There's also a very close connection between the situation of 2nd and 3rd John and the letter of 1st John. I'll give you perhaps just one example. In 1 John 4:3, we read, "Every spirit which does not confess Jesus is not of God. This is the spirit of the Antichrist, of which you heard that it was coming, and now it is in the world already." And when we studied 1 John, we talked about that verse. Then in 2 John, verse 7, we read, "Many deceivers have gone out into the world, men who will not acknowledge the coming of Jesus Christ in the flesh. Such a one is a deceiver and the Antichrist." And other parallels also exist, and I'll mention them when we get into the text of the letters themselves. But that's why all three of these letters need to be studied in relationship to one another. 2 John is interesting as it begins with the words, as I read a few moments ago, "The elder to the elect lady and her children." And we have to decide if this address is to an individual. The Greek is a combination of eklekte, which we translate as elect, and lady, which is the word kuria. And it seems like there are three possible options. First, in ancient Greek, we do find people called elekte. So it could be a proper name. And of course, lady in the title elect lady is simply a title of respect, as in the English we use gentleman, and in our phrase ladies and gentlemen. However, 2 John ends with the words, "The children of your elect sister greet you." And again, the Greek is eklekte, or elect. And the problem is that if we take eklekte as a proper name at the beginning of the letter, it must also be a proper name at the end of the letter. And this would mean that there were two sisters, both called by the very unusual name of eklekte, which doesn't seem a reasonable possibility. Second, it's possible that lady or kuria in Greek is a proper name. And there are examples in ancient literature of women having kuria as a name. If this is so, it's addressed to somebody called kuria, or the elect kuria, as we might say, the elect Susan, or the elect Miriam, or the elect, I don't know, Helen, or whatever you want to add as a modern parallel. However, the problem with that is throughout the letter, electe curia is addressed sometimes in the singular and sometimes in the plural. The plural occurs, let's see, in 2 John verses 4 and 5 and verse 13. And then the plural occurs in 2 John verses 6, 8, 10 and 12. And so if kuria is a proper name, there's no way it would be used of an individual in both the singular and the plural. it would make simply no sense. The third option is that John is addressing the church, and we have an example of this in 1 Peter. In the King James Version, 1 Peter ends with the words, "The church that is at Babylon, elected together with you, sends her greetings." However, the words "the church" are not in the Greek, and most modern translations of the verse read, "She who is in Babylon, chosen or elected together with you, sends her greetings." And this phrase obviously means the church in Babylon, which is why the translators of the King James Version added the word church. And this is helpful as it provides a parallel to how the word "elect lady" is used in John's letter. It's clearly in Peter, the church. She who is in Babylon, elected together with you, sends her greetings. And so, certainly the strongest of the possibilities is that John is writing to the church, and we have a strong parallel in 1 Peter. And of course, Israel was the bride of Yahweh, and the church is the bride of Christ, a metaphor that, of course, John, the author of these epistles, uses when he writes the book of Revelation. And so the best of the options seems to be that the chosen lady is a description of the church that John is writing to in his old age. So let's go to the text and read 2 John 1 and 2. "The elder to the elect lady," or the chosen lady, "and her children, whom I love in the truth, and not I only, but also all who know the truth, because of the truth which lives in us and will be with us forever." For John, truth is not simply propositional, but rather something that lives in us. And we know that what lives in us is the Spirit of Jesus, who himself said that he was the truth, and who also said that he would be with us forever. "Lo, I am with you always," Matthew 28. And there's been a lot of interest in recent years in the work of the philosopher Michael Polanyi, who said that we did not truly know anything just by observing and defining and quantifying it, but that to truly know something, we had to, in his words, to inhabit it. In other words, to truly know something, you don't stand as a dispassionate observer, detached and remote from what you're learning, but that to know it, you have to become embedded in it, committed to it, and implanted in it. And although Polanyi was not a Christian, Christian theologians and philosophers have become very interested in his work, as it seems to echo what Jesus said, again in John's Gospel, about the necessity to abide if we're to truly know. And you'll remember, of course, John 15, the word "abide, abide, abide" comes again and again. And it seems that Jesus is saying that if we are to truly know, we must abide. And of course, Polanyi's words that we must inhabit truth to know it, and the word "abide" that Jesus used, are virtual synonyms. And now here, many years later, after John heard Jesus use that little word "abide," here in his epistle, he's picking it up when he speaks in verse 2 about the truth which lives in us. Verse 3, grace, mercy, and peace will be with us from God the Father and Jesus Christ, the Father's Son, in truth and love. And this greeting is unusual in that it contains a promise. And that's not normal in most of the epistles. In fact, I think this might be unique. And the promise is that grace, mercy, and peace will be with us. And the church to whom John is writing is now being torn apart by the dictatorial actions of a man called Diotrephes. And we'll discover in 3 John that because of this, they badly needed this promise of grace, mercy, and peace. Not so much peace with God, but peace with each other. And that grace, mercy, and peace will be ours in truth and love sums up much of what John has to say in all 3 epistles. If we have truth but no love, we fail as the church. And if we have love but compromise the truth, we also fail. And John, who's often called the apostle of love, will not have love if it compromises the truth. He's writing to his children as a father, but he's still in his old age. You remember Jesus called him when he was a young man, a son of thunder. And he's still a son of thunder and is uncompromising in his insistence that truth and love must not be separated. Verse 4. It has given me much joy to find that some of your children, it's given me much joy to find some of your children walking in the truth, just as the Father commanded us. And now, dear lady, I'm writing you a new commandment, but one we've had from the beginning. I ask that we love one another, and this is love, that we walk in obedience to his commands, as you have heard from the beginning. His commandment is that you walk in love. Now, if you've listened to the teaching on 1 John, you heard me deal with the new commandment there and with John's linking of love and obedience, so I'll not repeat it again here. However, it's interesting that many of the teachings in 1 John are echoed in 2 and 3 John, as it gives us an insight into what John, in his old age, felt was crucial for him to reiterate, to say again and again and again to the churches under his leadership. And this means that the teaching in these epistles are John's legacy to the churches, a kind of last will and testament, and contain, as I say, truths that he was constantly emphasizing towards the end of his life. It was said of A.B. Simpson, the 19th century founder of the Christian and Missionary Alliance, that wherever he began preaching in Scripture, from Genesis to Revelation, he would always end up with Christ in you, the hope of glory, as this was the particular revelation that he carried. And in a similar way, it seems that whatever theme John starts with, he always seems to finish by telling us that we must walk in love. And this should not surprise us, as he tells us that God is love. and he had seen that love enfleshed in the person of Jesus, and now he has a passion to pass on this revelation to his beloved children before he dies. Verse 7. Many deceivers who do not acknowledge Jesus Christ as coming in the flesh have gone out into the world. Any such person is the deceiver and the Antichrist. Again, I've dealt with John's teaching on the spirit of the Antichrist that he identifies as the teaching of the early Gnostics. You remember that the heavenly Christ came upon the human Jesus at his baptism and left him before his crucifixion. And as I've said, if this was true, the atonement collapses and there is no forgiveness of sins. And John is passionate, even in his old age, in defending and proclaiming the truth that Jesus Christ did indeed come in the flesh. Many people have pointed out that Gnosticism is very much on the rise again in the day and age in which we live, not in the same form as in the first and second and third centuries, but it is certainly with us. And if you go back to my teaching on 1 John, I list some of the beliefs of Gnosticism, and you'll find them reflected in much popular belief today. But our stewardship as the church is to identify what is the spirit of Antichrist operating today. It won't be the same as what John was battling with, but the principles that John uses to expose error are the same as we use today. The error, the spirit of Antichrist may be promoting something quite different, but our job is to identify it and to expose it. And that's part of being faithful as ministers of the truth. Verse 8, watch out that you do not lose what you've worked for, but that you may be rewarded fully. Anyone who runs ahead does not continue in the teaching of Christ and does not have God. And running ahead is better translated, anyone who is advanced and will not remain in Christ's teaching does not possess God. And we could have some irony here, because the Gnostic think that they are advanced and that they have gone ahead of the average believer because they've received a hidden knowledge that is not freely available to everyone in the church. However, John says it's just the opposite, that those who think they're running ahead of the pack and that they're advanced in some sort of esoteric knowledge of God, in reality, because they're not continuing in the apostolic doctrine, are deceived, and in fact do not even have God, yet alone having a status above that of the normal believer. Then in verse 9, he continues by affirming that, quote, whoever continues in the teaching has both the Father and the Son. And this is very much again a repeat of what he recorded in chapter 14 of his gospel, that by the Spirit both the Father and the Son abide in the believer. And how the Gnostics could believe that they could have a deeper truth than this astonishes me. The thought that by the Spirit both the Father and the Son abide in the believer is a truth bigger than I, for one, can even begin to grasp. And it's difficult to imagine anyone thinking that they had been initiated into a truth that in some way eclipses what Jesus himself said to the disciples immediately before going to the cross. Moving on to verse 10. If anyone comes to you and does not bring this teaching, do not take him into your house or welcome him. Anyone who welcomes him shares in his wicked work. And giving hospitality to itinerating teachers, prophets, evangelists, etc., was an important dimension of life in the early church. And such workers could not afford to stay in the inns along the road, which were also expensive, filthy, and often served as brothels. However, if any such itinerant workers did not hold to the apostolic teaching, John says that they dare not bring them into their homes. And he's not being harsh. John is the apostle of love, but he knows that the best way to love those who undermine the truth is to reject their presence in our midst. And perhaps such a powerful rejection, if it's done in the right spirit, will cause them to realize that they're outside the boundaries of orthodoxy and lead them to re-examine their teaching. And so he continues, verse 12, I have much to write to you, but I do not want to use paper and ink. Instead, I hope to visit you and talk with you face to face so that our joy might be complete. And Christianity is incarnational. And although John could communicate in writing, and in our day we can have internet churches, being with each other face to face is central to Christianity. The gospel is a proclamation that in Jesus Christ, God himself has visited us face to face. And John had seen that beautiful embodiment of truth and knows that his calling is to reflect some of the glory of Jesus into the church by his bodily presence among them. And for John, that will make his joy complete. Somebody said that the gospel is the gospel of belonging. And because we belong to each other, our joy is made complete by simply being in the presence of each other. And that is what John longs for. And so he says, yes, I could write great tomes to you, but I want to see you face to face. Then he finishes in verse 13, the children of your elect sister or chosen sister send their greetings. And he concludes his letter by sending greetings on behalf of the members of the congregation from which his writing, whom he describes as their chosen sister. And family relationships permeate the writings of John, beginning in his gospel with the relationships within the Trinitarian family itself. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. And so it's almost his signature to sign off by describing the church from which he's writing as the sister, as a family member of the elect lady to whom the letter is addressed. And again, in an era when evangelical churches have tended to be islands of independency, it's interesting to note that strong links existed among the churches that John was responsible for. And with that, we finish 2 John, but I'm going to move on to 3 John and deal with it fairly rapidly. 3 John is written to somebody called Gaius, who's obviously deeply loved by John and probably an elder in the church. However, the situation behind 3 John is somewhat more complicated than in 2 John. And it seems that, again, itinerant teachers, prophets, evangelists, apostles, probably from John himself, had come to the church, and Gaius had welcomed them and given them hospitality. He spells this out in verses 5 through 8. Speaking to Gaius, he says, "Dear friend, you're faithful in what you're doing for the brothers, even though they're strangers to you. They have told the church about your love." They have probably sent a letter or some team members back to John's church with a report, at least an initial report, of how they were doing. Then verse 6 continues, "You will do well to send them on their way in a manner worthy of God." Then verse 7, "It was for the sake of the name that they went out, receiving no help from the pagans. We ought therefore to show hospitality to such men, so that we may work together for the truth." However, in the same church is a man called Diotrephes, who John says loves to be first. In addition, in verse 9, John says that Diotrephes does not acknowledge our authority. And in verse 10, that he talks wicked nonsense about us. And in addition, John says also in verse 10, that Diotrephes refuses to welcome the brothers, by which he means the team that has been sent from John, and also stops those who want to welcome them, and even puts them out of the church, simply for showing hospitality. Then there's also somebody called Demetrius, who in verse 12, John says, is spoken well of by everyone, and who John himself speaks highly of. The situation could have been that Demetrius was the leader of the team, and that they'd made one trip before, were welcomed by Gaius, and are now on their way back to the church to minister to them again. Or some of the team had remained behind to minister, while others had returned with a report to John. Whichever way round it was, John knows that Diotrephes will refuse to have anything to do with them, and will again try and put out of the church those who give them hospitality. So part of the reason John is writing the letter is to encourage Gaius to receive the team again and not be intimidated by Diotrephes, who seems to have seized the helm of the church, but who John says he will deal with when he comes to visit himself. Now, if this reconstruction is correct, it throws some light on the way the early church governed itself. It seems that there was a plurality of local elders, with one of them possibly acting as the first among equals. However, in this situation, Diotrephes is not acting as first among equals, a role that Gaius probably should have had. But Diotrephes has taken over the leadership of the church, and any plurality of elders is now only tokenism. And Diotrephes, probably a charismatic figure and a strong personality, has seized the helm. So one of the first interesting things we discover from this little book is that in the early church, we already have an example of one man, by sheer force of his personality, heading up a church that should have been led by a plurality of leaders. However, John the Apostle is still around, and while not having any direct role in the governance of this local church, by virtue of his being one of the 12 apostles, it's clear that he regards himself as having the right to act as a father to those he regards as his children. And this throws up a dimension that's sadly lacking in many local churches today, that they don't have any older statesmen who are in a fatherly relationship to the church and can give objective counsel when there's conflict in the local leadership. If someone could act as John is doing here, many churches could avoid painful splits and breakdowns of relationships, which all of us have either experienced ourselves or we've been in relationship to people who have been in such situations, which are so very, very painful. And in addition, it reveals that local churches did not see themselves as self-sufficient, but rather that they welcomed and were enriched by itinerant teams of anointed individuals who would visit them from time to time. And the gifts of those who are anointed in the fivefold ministries, apostles, prophets, pastors, teachers, etc., from outside the local church are needed if a church is to flourish and grow as God intended. And when a local church believes itself to be totally self-sufficient, one usually finds a character like Diotrephes, who, in order to protect his position, will not welcome in anointed outsiders as they might seek to admonish him. So in this little book of just 14 verses, we have some important insights as to how the early local churches operated, and from which we can learn some crucial lessons about governance in the local church today. So let's begin reading the text, verse 1. The elder to my dear friend Gaius, whom I love in the truth. And this is the only one of the three epistles of John to be addressed to a named individual. Paul's letter to Philemon is also personal, as well as being equally short, and many see it as having some parallels with 3 John. Verse 2, dear friend, I pray that you may enjoy good health and that all may go well with you, even as your soul is getting along well. That's the NIV, and Stephen Smalley translates the verse, dear friend, I pray that you may prosper in every way and be well in body, even as I know you're well in spirit. And John prays for Gaius that he may prosper, and the Greek word prosper literally means to be led along a good road or to have a good journey. And metaphorically, as in this passage, it means to succeed or to prosper. And it's interesting to note that in 1 Corinthians 16:2, the word prosper is used of financial prosperity. And then he adds, and to be well in body, as I know that you're well in spirit. And this might indicate that Gaius was not physically robust, and therefore John prays that he might be strong physically, just as he is strong in spirit. Then verse 3, it gave me great joy to have some brothers come and tell about your faithfulness to the truth and how you continue to walk in the truth. John is probably speaking of the team that had visited the church to which Gaius belonged, and as I said before, it's possible that some had returned to John and reported on the problems in the church. And it was this report that made John aware of the domineering behaviour of Diotrephes, and also how he heard of the godly actions and character of his friend Gaius. Then verse 4, I have no greater joy than to hear that my children are walking in the truth. And as I pointed out in 2 John, truth and love sum up much of what John has to say in all three of these epistles. As I said, if we have truth but no love, we fail the church. And if we have love but compromise the truth, we equally fail. And again, John is uncompromising in his insistence that truth and love must and cannot be separated. And I just love John, this aged man, just hammering away at the truth, because he knows that these are the fundamentals. This is bedrock. And he wants to place this bedrock of truth under these churches. Verse 5. Dear friend, you're faithful in what you're doing for the brothers, even though they're strangers to you. John says that even though those who made up the traveling team were strangers to Gaius, he had given them an embrace. He'd given them hospitality. He'd given them a warm welcome into the midst. As I've said, hospitality was a crucial practice in the early church. We read 1 Peter 4:9, practice hospitality ungrudgingly to one another. And in Hebrews 13:2, that we must not neglect to show hospitality to strangers. And he adds that by doing so, some have entertained angels unknowingly. Paul says that a widow is to be honored if she has shown hospitality. 1 Timothy 5:9. And he tells the church at Rome that they must practice hospitality. That's Romans 12:13. And Barclay points out that when we come to the time of Justin Martyr, around the year 170 AD, he writes that on the Lord's Day, a collection would be taken each week to support the orphans and widows, those who were sick, those who were in prison. That's believers who were suffering imprisonment for their faith. And in Justin Martyr's words, the strangers sojourning among us. In other words, those who were passing through and needed hospitality and perhaps provisions or money to see them on their way. And then John continues, again verse 6, they, that's the traveling team, have told the church, again, probably the church where John was based, they have told the church about your love. As I said, some had probably returned to John with an initial report, both positive and negative, about what was going on. Then he exhorts Gaius to send them on their way in a manner worthy of God. In other words, to make sure the team are provided with their basic needs to enable them to continue with their mission. And I love that phrase, to send them on their way in a manner worthy of God. In other words, he's hinting not just with their minimal kind of essentials, but in a manner worthy of God. Give them encouragement. Give them perhaps... as much and even more than they need for the next stage of their mission. Moving on to verse 7. It was for the sake of the name that they went out, receiving no help from the pagans, which could be translated, for they have gone out in the name of Jesus, accepting nothing from unbelievers. And the reason why the team accepted nothing from unbelievers is not clear. Jesus, you remember, in Mark 6 and Matthew 10, told his disciples that they were to take nothing for their journey and to accept hospitality from the houses in which they stayed. However, their mission was to the lost sheep of the house of Israel, and so the likelihood is that they would have been offered hospitality from pious Jews. However, the situation in Asia Minor was very different. Traveling teachers of pagan religions, along with itinerant philosophers, astrologers, and magicians were common. And I think I've mentioned that before. And it's possible that John did not want his traveling disciples to be confused with pagan itinerants who were in it for the money. And therefore, he had told them not to receive any support from unbelievers, even if they were well-meaning. Verse 8, we ought therefore to show hospitality to such men so that we may work together for the truth. John's view is that by supporting the traveling disciples, we become shareholders in their ministry. We may not travel, but whether we're sent out or whether we stay behind and support the local work, together we work to advance the truth and to extend the kingdom. Verse 9, I've written something to the church, but Diotrephes, who likes to put himself first, does not acknowledge our authority. So if I come, I will bring up what he's doing, talking wicked nonsense about us. And not content with that, he refuses to welcome the brothers and also stops those who want to and puts them out of the church. And the behavior of Diotrephes is so outrageous, as I said before, that he not only refuses to welcome the team from John, but also puts out of the church those who do welcome them. And to be put out of the church was a very, very severe discipline. And we can only imagine that Diotrephes so wanted to consolidate his power that he did everything he could to avoid being exposed and admonished by the disciples of John. And it seems unbelievable that a leader in a church under the oversight of the Apostle John would not only refuse to receive his disciples, but also put out of the church those who did. And we often have an idealistic view of the early church, but here we have a power struggle that equals anything we might read about today. And this is why this letter is so valuable and so revealing, both in the positive and in the negative. They wrestled with what we often wrestle with. And then verse 11, dear friend, do not imitate what is evil, but what is good. Anyone who does what is good is from God. Anyone who does what is evil has not seen God. And when John makes statements like, anyone who does what is good is from God, they need to be placed in context and not used as statements isolated from the totality of his teaching. His statement, anyone who does what is good is from God, does not stand in isolation. There are many people who do what is good but do not have a personal relationship with God. But this statement is embedded in John's belief that he clearly spells out in the first epistle that knowing God in the person of his Son and being indwelt by his Spirit is what enables us to be those who do what is good and so let our light shine that others will see our good works and glorify our Father in heaven. As we often say, a text out of context becomes a pretext, and some of John's statements are open to being misused if they're isolated from the main body of his teaching. And so it's important in handling these epistles that we don't simply take something out of context, because that could grossly distort what John is in fact teaching. Verse 12. Demetrius is spoken well of by everyone, and even by the truth itself. We also speak well of him, and you know that our testimony is true. And Smalley mentions that the name Demetrius means belonging to Demeter. And Demeter was the Greek goddess of fruit and crops, and was at the center, in fact, of an annual cultic mystery rite that took place near Athens. And so Demetrius obviously came from a pagan family, because he was named after this pagan god Demeter, and therefore John's official confirmation of his good character and doctrinal orthodoxy and of his credibility as a witness to the truth in the present power struggle would have been so helpful in strengthening the position of Gaius and others like him. And John adds, again, verse 12, Demetrius is well spoken of by everyone and even by the truth itself. And this could be translated, even by the testimony of the truth, and could mean that his whole way of life expressed a commitment, an embodiment of the truth of Christ. Again, Smalley says it well, that no further testimony to his character was needed, for the truth, by its own light, shone in all his actions. That's beautiful, isn't it? That the truth shone by its own light in all his actions. Then verse 13, I have much to write to you, but I do not want to do so with pen and ink. I hope to see you soon, and we will talk face to face. As I've mentioned, our written communication could not replace personal contact with those in the churches for which John had oversight. And even though he was old, he would make what could have been a very difficult overland journey so he can spend time with them face to face, which is really mouth to mouth in Greek. That's very expressive, isn't it? Mouth to mouth. We look somebody in the eyes. We read their lips. We are in their presence. And then he concludes, peace to you. The friends here send their greetings. Greet the friends there by name. And probably behind this request to greet the friends by name is a desire on the part of John that Gaius will share the contents of the letter with the members of the church. And that's true of some of the other personal epistles that are sent, it seems that Paul, and in this case John, are expecting, although they're personal letters, that they will be shared with the church, which I suppose is why we have them today in the Bible. If he didn't, we'd never have heard of it. And he says, and this is so beautiful, he says, greet the friends there by name. And the only other use of the phrase by name in the New Testament is in John, the Gospel of John, 10:3, where Jesus says he calls his own sheep by name, and leads them out. And if this text from the Gospel that John himself had written was in his mind, it would be a beautiful way of ending his last epistle. And it would also highlight that his only greeting those who shared with him in the apostolic doctrine that has been his chief concern in all three of these letters of John. It's a lovely thought that his last words, greet them by name, is a reflection of what he wrote in his gospel, that he remembered that Jesus had said so long ago that he calls his own sheep by name. And these folks are John's sheep. And so he says, greet them, my children, my sheep, greet them by name. And with this he finishes the letter, and as I've said, 2nd and 3rd John are often the Cinderellas of the New Testament, but they've much to teach us today. And I trust that this very, very brief overview will whet your appetite to dig deeper into what these neglected epistles, not that 1 John is neglected, but I do believe that 2 and 3 John are very neglected, but they have much to teach us. And with this, we end our study.